Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. In this podcast, we're talking about the Spanish-American War, but sort of a broader context following Admiral Dewey's career path as he began in an era of sailing ships where sailors that were veterans of the War of 1812 still held sway, and they were the admirals of the age, through the end of Dewey's career, where he was involved in the first years of submarine and naval aviation. And so just a remarkable career that was capped off by what he is famous for, obviously, which is the leadership of the Battle of Manila, which ultimately secured the Philippines as a United States colony for roughly 50 years. And with me to discuss this, I have David Smith, who is, in addition to being a senior lecturer at Baylor University, he wrote A New Force at Sea, George Dewey and the Rise of the American Navy. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Chase. It's great to be with you.
So I wanted to ask you first, you covered really well Dewey's career from when he commissioned at the very outbreak of the Civil War through, as I mentioned, the advent of naval aviation and submarine warfare. And he was one of those guys that even getting into his old age, I mean, he served until he was in his 70s, he had an extremely long career. What was a big proponent of that? He wasn't the stick in the mud type naval officer, which is somewhat of a stereotype given the number of naval officers that have adhered to tradition and, you know, battleships and wooden sailing ships far beyond the time that they were actually useful.
Right.
Why was that? Can you talk about sort of the naval evolution throughout his career?
You know, he came up in an era of sailing ships and veterans of the War of 1812 giving these stories about how it was back in the old days. And he didn't really have a sense of the development of naval technology until he got through the Civil War and began to sort of cruise around the world as an officer and see what other navies were doing. And he had this rather unique opportunity in time to compare the ship that he was on in the 1880s with brand new ships from Japan and from Great Britain and from France that would be sailing past him while he was on the European station, sailing in the Med and seeing these other ships of other countries that were clearly embracing modern technology, steel, steam, all that stuff. And it gave him the ability to appreciate the interplay of tradition and innovation that a lot of officers who were more conservative by nature didn't fully endorse the transition to coal-powered steel-hulled ships. And it disappointed him when he found that he was a lonely voice trying to embrace change and pushing his fellow officers in the direction of innovation.
So the Navy very, very briefly took the technological lead with monitors, you know, / ironclads during the Civil War.
Sure,
the U.S.
Yeah.
Navy was a bit of an innovator there, but then immediately, you know, as per the American tradition, demobilized the entire Navy and lost the plot. So you talk about the comparisons that George Dewey encountered in his immediate post-Civil War career, where he very much started on a paddle wheeler, right? So think, you know, side paddle wheeler, the stuff going up and down the Mississippi, right? Old South style. But post-war, the United States abandoned any and all technological progress. You know, what did he encounter in Europe with more modern navies? And in comparison, what was the U.S. Navy sailing around at that time?
The U.S. Navy was sailing ships that had been commissioned in the 1850s. The U.S. Navy was sailing ships on the European station that he had served with when Farragut took the fleet up the Mississippi in 62 to take New Orleans. And he understood that technology had moved on, and he was upset, he was resentful a little bit that when the Civil War ended, the U.S. Navy was the biggest in the world. And like you said, it had these cutting-edge technology of monitors and stuff. But what was cutting-edge technology in 1863 was no longer cutting-edge technology in 1883. And the rest of, you know, great power navies had embraced these changes. And he, whether he was sailing or whether he was desk-bound, he had this feeling that the United States didn't really, or at least in Congress, right? Congress didn't want a Navy. Congress didn't want to spend the money for a Navy. And it was something that he battled from many desk positions at the Bureau of Equipment, for instance, trying to get a critical mass in Congress to understand that unless the U.S. Navy evolves and goes forward and embraces new technology, it's going to be really worthless. And when there was a little bit of a war scare with Spain in the early 70s, that became really obvious. You know, the whole of the American fleet, such as it was, concentrated at Key West to go down and avenge the death of some American sailors in Cuba. And there was no way that the Americans could have stood up against anything that the Spanish had. So during the war itself, during the Civil War, the U.S. Navy was willing to embrace change and technology and innovation. And you saw this with the Monitor, right? This whole class of ship called the Monitor, named for the first one, with a rotating turret with only two guns. And that sort of thing really excited naval officers when they saw them in action. There was a scene in which Dewey passed through Charleston Harbor, and there were several monitors there of different sorts, and he saw the future. And when the war ended, the U.S. Navy had more ships than anybody else in the world. And Dewey was sort of hopeful that the momentum could be carried forward into the 1870s, and that what the U.S. Navy had learned during the war about innovation, about tactics and operations, could sort of become standard even in peacetime. But you have Congress cutting back the naval budget, cutting the number of ships by half, and then by half again. While other countries are starting to experiment with things like steel hulls, armor belts, more efficient steam engines. And the U.S. Navy didn't do any of that. The U.S. Navy basically said what was good for the 1950s is good for now. And you had ships, you know, sailing around the world with the American flag from 1865 to 1885, basically, that were this weird combination of early steam technology, but they still had masts and sails. And the Navy was under strict orders. You don't fire up that engine for any reason unless there's no wind at all, or unless like an officer falls overboard, right? We're not going to burn coal just for the sake of you getting someplace quicker. And it's that reluctance to go into everything that new technology sort of demands that caused the Navy to be resistant to things like running their engines full time and not building sailing masts on steamships.
And in comparison, what was the rest of the industrialized world doing? What was Europe, Japan? They were modernizing at a massive clip, right?
Yeah, the rest of the world, led by the English, of course, were going more and more with steel hulls, more and more with powerful steam engines that ate a lot of coal. I mean, the thing is, the Navy budget, and Dewey knew this, if we go in the direction of steam engines all the time, our coal budget, our maintenance, our supply budgets, they're going to go through the roof, but they have to. And Congress said, it doesn't matter. If you've got sails, use them, because we don't want to spend the money for coal. And other countries like Britain, like France, Germany after 1871, Japan, they were sort of full on embracing the future of propulsion, the future of armor, and the future of big guns.
And that sort of, you know, reluctance to embrace new technology puts the United States behind when eventually the writing is truly on the wall, you know, come the early 1880s, when Congress mm-hmm. is like, oh, you know, maybe we do need to build a peacetime Navy for the first time ever, you know, right. Investment, ARG. And they decide, yes, we will do this. But at this point, all the good islands in the Pacific have been gobbled up for the most part. And, you know, suddenly it becomes the Navy's looking at, okay, well, we got a base in Hawaii. And that's about it, right?
Exactly. You know, it's the case that all of this depends on what you think a Navy should do and what the U.S. Navy should be built to do. And if you're somebody in Congress who thinks that a Navy just ought to be a coastal defense force, they don't need to have big coal bunkers and powerful steamships, because they're going to stay at home and they're not going to go gallivanting off and getting in trouble someplace. But people who had been in the Navy and sailed the world, watch this other technology, understood that the world is changing in a way that is bringing the world more closely together. It's globalizing, to use today's word. The world is a more interconnected place, and the U.S. Navy has to be able to cross oceans even if we're not going to go out and grab colonies, we need to be able to secure trade routes and protect our trade routes and sail wherever we want to under the concept of a free sea. But if you think that a coastal defense navy is all we need, you're not going to spring for the money, right? You're not going to allocate the money to build these new ships.
And so what actually did spur Congress to finally decide to appropriate some real money for a peacetime navy?
You know, it was Chester Arthur, who became president when Garfield was assassinated, who really starts this. And in 1884, as he's going out of office, he comes out, sort of surprises people, comes out as a defender of naval innovation and says that the world is changing. We need to embrace steel-hulled ships. We need to embrace modern propulsion. And right as he was leaving office, he got the 4 steel-hulled ships, the first ones that the United States is going to lay down, authorized to and started. So it's really Chester Arthur. And this is kind of hard to tell because there's nothing in his past that makes him sort of aware of this. But for whatever reason, Chester Arthur embraced the cause of a modern navy. And with the 4 ships that were authorized at the tail end of his administration, that's when the U.S. Navy begins to sort of push reluctantly toward the future.
Was the debacle of the Virginius affair the inciting event that helped turn public opinion, ultimately congressional opinion, towards the need to invest in, not just, like you said, steel ships and propulsion, but there was also, this was truly an inflection point in almost every single realm of naval technology, and there hasn't been an inflection point like this.
Right.
I think in all of naval history, I think this is the single biggest inflection point, including the transition from surface gunnery, aka battleships, to aircraft carriers. I don't think that was as big as the roughly 60-year transition from sail power to steam power, and then that continuing transition to steel hulls and turrets and modern gunnery and steam, and then sort of capping off with the dreadnoughts and oil propulsion. I mean, that was just an amazing 60 years. And that's, in history, that is extremely unique. And the United States was extremely late for that. And getting back to the original question, was the Virginius affair debacle the inciting incident there?
The Virginius affair that involved basically an American ship running guns to a Cuban rebellion. There was an American ship called the Virginius. It was captained by, I believe, a former Confederate. And it was running guns to the Cuban rebels. This was in the early 1870s. And the Spanish caught them and arrested the whole crew. And the Spanish general in Cuba began executing American sailors one by one. And this, inflamed public opinion. It inflamed the Navy Department. The Navy concentrated its ships at Key West. The thing is, the public that's inflamed about this, they have no idea what kind of condition the U.S. Navy's in. It's only naval officers and the people who are on these ships that know if we go up against the modern Spanish ships, we're going to be blown out of the water.
And the Spanish are by no means heavy hitters in the realm of naval power at this point. They are
exactly
a very firmly second-rate power.
They're a second-rate power, but they've got bigger ships with bigger guns and stronger hulls than we do. And the naval officers who were deployed knew that. The captains of these ships that mustered down at Key West, Dewey was in the Gulf of California at the time, they understood that there's nothing that we have that can go up against the biggest guns of the Spanish fleet. Like you said, and the Spanish fleet's not even the best in the world by a long shot. And so the Virginius affair really sort of built more momentum that worked its way up from naval officers up to the Secretary of the Navy. And the Secretary of the Navy in the 1870s wasn't really a very capable person and had really no knowledge of the Navy. But we get into the 80s and we get a little bit better leadership on the civilian side of the Navy. And it takes a while for interests to sort of bubble up to the top level. So I guess you could say that the Virginius affair was one of the events that sort of gradually started pushing the U.S. Navy and the civilian side to embracing new technology and building sort of new ships from scratch, really, rather than refitting and repairing the old ones.
And so this sort of brings us to the Navy starting, as you mentioned, in the 1880s, starts building up. And the second time that there is a inciting incident with the Spanish, who had a number of colonies in the Caribbean, which, you know, were constantly rebelling and in conflict with U.S. Right. interests. This is what causes more or less the Spanish-American War, right?
Right. Starting in 1895, the Spanish started really cracking down on this rebellion on the island of Cuba. And that's when the New York City newspapers, you know, the newspaper war and yellow journalism, they started covering that as salaciously as possible. And that built up the public interest in the United States should do something to defend the rebels in Cuba, who are, after all, the argument went, doing the same thing we did back in the 1770s. So it's basically the newspaper coverage and the slant, the angle that the newspapers gave to the situation in Cuba that began to put public pressure on Congress and the McKinley administration to do something to calm Cuba down. And that's why McKinley sent the Maine to Havana in December of 97, which, you know, the Maine blows up in February of 98.
And this is actually one of the things I learned from your book is I did not realize that the immediate conclusion of everyone up and down the chain of command was, oh yeah, it must have been an accident, obviously. And yeah, it's not until significantly later that everybody comes to the perhaps convenient conclusion that, oh no, it must have been Spanish sabotage.
Exactly, right. Everybody who knew the hazards of new ships and, you know, half-empty coal bunkers and that sort of thing, they knew that this was a common hazard. But then, right, then you get somebody like Theodore Roosevelt, who, like, the next day says this was clearly Spain. And then New York City newspapers like The World and The Journal, they pick up on that. And then you get these headlines, Spanish treachery destroys the Maine and kills all these American sailors. But the consensus among professional Navy people was that, yeah, this thing happens.
So in this intervening 25 years in between the Virginius affair in 1873 and 1898, when the Maine blows up, the United States has undergone a massive naval revolution, has built modern ships, and Spain knows that they are massively outgunned, so they're very conciliatory, but the forces of yellow journalism, sort of the conspiring with a lot of colonialists and imperialists, mm-hmm. which were a faction of the U.S. body politic, although there was, right. you know, a very large anti-imperialist faction as well, that sort of snowballed, and we end up ultimately in the Spanish-American War, in which we get to our hero of the episode, George Dewey, who has conveniently just been placed in charge of the Asiatic Fleet, right?
Yeah, George Dewey takes command of the East Asia Squadron at the tail end of 97. So he's in position when the Spanish-American War breaks out to do something decisive against the Spanish holdings in the Pacific. Now, the thing is, the American public was all enraged about Cuba. Nobody in the American public was even giving a second thought to the Pacific, let alone the Philippines, which most people couldn't even find on a globe at the time. But the Navy had already thought this through. The Navy knew that in times of war, remote colonies are vulnerabilities. And that if the United States goes to war against Spain, one of the things that the Navy uniquely can do would be to attack Spanish colonies elsewhere. So there was a plan. As Dewey went across the Pacific, right, in December of 97, he reviewed the plans that said, if we go to war with Spain, attack Manila, right? But it wasn't, the purpose was not to grab a colony. The purpose was to take out the Spanish squadron at Manila so they don't get out and attack us someplace, but also hold Manila and use it as a bargaining chip for whatever happens at the end of this war, right? I mean, war back then, this is something I think we lose track of. War back then, it was made up of different steps, some of which were designed to be used in negotiations later. So we're going to take Manila, not because we want to keep it, but because we're going to use it for leverage over Spain when we finally get to the negotiating table. So when George Dewey gets to Japan, takes command of the squadron, he already knows that in the event of a war, Manila is going to be his target.
And in the event of a war, he almost has to take Manila, though, because of the logistical considerations and because the U.S. was late to the, oh yeah, let's power our ships with coal game.
Right.
There was no impetus to take any possessions in Asia and the broader Pacific, right? You know, Britain had Hong Kong, Britain had lots of islands, so did France.
Right.
Germany was definitely sniffing around because they were also late because they unified only relatively recently. They were becoming a naval power for the first time. And so the laws of war meant that any U.S. ships had to evacuate neutral ports, which everyone was neutral except for the Spanish, who weren't going to let us coal in their ports. And the nearest U.S. port was Hawaii, which was thousands of miles away. And certainly there would be no effective fighting force based out of Hawaii in the Pacific.
All right. That's part of the reason that Dewey was always so worried about his ammo supply and his coal supply, because he knew that once war is declared, and right, that's a timeline that he doesn't control at all. He knew that once war is declared, he's going to have to leave Hong Kong, and he's not going to have a friendly port, and he's going to have to basically subsist on the ammo he's got and the coal he's got until he can be resupplied from the West Coast. And it makes him very worried about his coal levels, and it makes him very worried about his ammunition levels. And that's also the root of the reason why he doesn't just steam away from Manila after he annihilates the Spanish fleet, because he really doesn't have a place to go.
So I want to back up a little bit. Can you tell, you know, myself and the audience a little bit
Sure.
about, you know, Dewey's decision-making and calculus immediately preceding the Battle of Manila, and then what happens in the Battle of Manila?
So one of the things that Dewey does when he knows that the relationship between the United States and Spain is deteriorating, he takes his squadron and he relocates the squadron away from Japan and at Hong Kong, because it's much, much closer to Manila. And when he arrives in Hong Kong on the Olympia, that's when he gets word that the Maine has exploded in Havana. And that's the point at which he begins to seriously think about war being inevitable, right? And he knows what he's going to do operationally. He knows that he's going to take his squadron, he's going to go to Manila and do what he has to do. But he's not ready to yet. He doesn't have as much ammo as he wants. He knows that there's a ship coming called the Baltimore from the West Coast, loaded with ammo. And he's not going to go to Manila without that load of ammo. Plus, he wants the Baltimore and its guns as well. So after war is declared, the governor of Hong Kong comes down to the harbor and tells him, you know, I hate to tell you this, but you've got to leave because of the laws of neutrality, like we've said. And Dewey leaves Hong Kong and retreats to a bay up the coast a little bit in China, basically because he knows that nobody's going to be there to tell him to get lost, right? There's no authority there that can tell him to move on. It's not a port facility, but at least he can do a little gunnery practice and he can wait until his squadron is concentrated. Once that happens, he sails to the Philippines, crosses the South China Sea, sails down the west coast of Luzon. He's really worried that the Spanish fleet would be at a place called Subic Bay, because he knows that if the Spanish are at Subic Bay, it's going to be a lot harder for him to come in and take it out with a battle, because Subic Bay is narrower. He's going to be covered with guns from shore more readily. So when he finds out that the Spanish aren't at Subic and they are at Manila, he said that was one of the happiest days of his life. So he goes on, he takes his squadron down to the entrance to Manila Bay. And this is the point at which Dewey's character begins to drive the possible streams of narration, right? If you had another commander, that commander could have brought the squadron down and basically blockaded Manila from the outside of the bay and not exposed his ships to the guns at the narrows, not exposed his ships to the possibility of a minefield, not exposed his ships to the coastal artillery that he knows is at Manila and on the south side of the bay. But Dewey is aggressive, and he's going to interpret orders as an aggressive commander in the style of Farragut, who shaped him during the Civil War. So he runs his fleet by the guns at the mouth of Manila Bay, in the same way that Farragut ran his ships by the guns south of New Orleans. He doesn't know exactly where the Spanish are going to be. He knows they're in Manila. He knows that they could be at Manila proper, or they could be down on the south side of the bay at a place called Cavite. This takes place over the night of April 30 to May 1st. It's a Saturday night to a Sunday morning. He cruises across Manila slowly, gives his crew a chance to rest. When he gets to Manila, the sun is just coming up, and he realizes that the Spanish are not here at Manila, which tells him that they're on the south side of the bay at an anchorage called Cavite. So he hangs a right, heads straight southward down the coast toward Cavite, and he finally sees the ships of the Spanish squadron ahead of him, anchored in a really good, sound defensive position. And you got to remember that Dewey doesn't know much about the character of the Spanish ships, so he sort of has to assume that they're at least capable of inflicting damage on him.
He's going in blind. He has a rough idea that his fleet is superior to the Spanish, but there was no intelligence service whatsoever. And really, there was a huge question mark over how many ships, which ships, where reinforcements are reinforcements coming? And sort of over this whole scenario, the Spanish do have one really powerful battleship, which caused them to worry. And meanwhile, the U.S. has completely lost track of this ship.
Yeah, exactly. They don't know where it is. And this is like after the battle, Dewey assumes that the Spanish would deploy immediately something to Manila for the Battle of Manila Bay Part 2. But on this Sunday morning, May 1st, Dewey finds the Spanish ships, goes right at them, takes his ships in a column toward them, and holds his fire, right? Remember, he's worried about wasting ammunition. Holds his fire even after the Spanish have started shooting at him. Holds his fire until he gets close enough to where he thinks that, okay, my guys can hit the Spanish with every shot. And then this column swings into a line, and we've got a good old-fashioned traditional naval encounter of ships passing each other broadside, slamming away at each other. And Dewey takes his ships back and forth in front of the Spanish line. And the Spanish line, remember, is anchored, so they're not moving. But Dewey is moving the whole time back and forth in this slow oval. And he sends all the Spanish ships to the bottom.
Dewey instantly becomes the United States' first celebrity. You talk a lot about in your book about how it's almost hard to overstate the absolute level of fame. And there was probably nobody else, you know, maybe save George Washington in American history, who was as famous and popular as George Dewey was. But sort of the question that I had reading the book, and maybe you can talk a little bit about this, is what was his value over replacement in the Spanish-American War, in that the Spanish were abysmal. They were pushovers, as it turned out. The forts, you know, didn't perform well that the Spanish had. The Spanish ships were old and outgunned and wooden in many cases. And would any other competent officer have done just as well, and had war broken out immediately before Dewey's tenure in the Pacific or immediately after, would anything have changed?
Right.
Yeah. You know, would sort of the standard replacement, equal rank officer, presumably somewhat competent, have done just as well? I want to read from a couple of things in your book where you have a quote where he's entering Manila Bay. The fear of mines was the more unnerving worry for the men below deck. Mining a wide channel like this in time of war was standard procedure, and the ship would have almost no warning if it came upon a mine in the darkness. Spoiler alert, the Spanish failed to mine the channel. There's, you know, some other quotes about the Spanish admiral ordered some sort of prudent and smart measures to be taken, and they were not, and he was sort of aghast to find out that they were not taken.
Exactly.
Again, you know, sort of points to Spanish rank and competence, and both sides were absolutely horrible at gunnery. The only saving grace is that the Spanish were worse. And I sort of looked up this statistic on the accuracy of U.S. gunnery. Of the 5,859 shells expended, only 170 managed to hit the Spanish vessels, which is a...
That'll get you benched right there.
Right. I mean, and, you know, if you were facing anyone other than the Spanish, who are rank incompetents as they showed themselves to be, they, you know, that the battle would have been lost. Mm-hmm. And the sailors themselves were sort of surprised that Dewey was being treated as this hero, not because they didn't, you know, think he was a good leader, but because it was a cakewalk. There were about 5 casualties on the U.S. side, vice a complete destruction of the Spanish fleet. And so how much was Dewey and how much was just we had better stuff and the Spanish were incompetent?
That's a really, really good question. And every historian who writes biographies has to sort of wrestle with that, right? You know, how is it that the person I'm writing about is as central as a biography implies him to be? And you're right that the Navy had lots of capable commanders, but then it comes down to how a commander would have chosen to interpret the orders that he was under. And Dewey was aggressive and not rash, but he was willing to take risks. A good commander knows when to risk the fleet, they say. And Dewey knew exactly that, yes, there could be mines, but for this reason, I believe that they won't affect me. Yes, there could be coastal artillery, but I believe that I can get my ships past it. Yes, the Spanish might be able to take some of my ships out, but it doesn't matter. I'm going right after them. So it's Dewey's personality that shapes how the battle plays out. And another commander may have brought the U.S. squadron to Manila and blockaded it at a distance and just let it sort of sit there and waited for something like that to happen, waited for a resolution to come from the home front. But it's Dewey is the person who leads this, who shapes the battle the way it does. And I think that if there had been another commander, another commodore, right, of the squadron, you might not have had the same kind of lopsided battle, because all of the choices that Dewey made up until that point were what shaped the outcome. It's sort of like a conductor and a symphony, right? If you go watch a symphony and you look at the conductor up there and you think anybody could be there because he's just standing there waving his arms, what is he doing? But when you see a conductor in a symphony concert, the conductor has done all the work already. And that's the same way it is with a Navy commander like Dewey. Dewey has already shaped everything that's going to happen, and he just has to stand there and watch it play out in a way that would make somebody think, well, gosh, anybody could have been commander of this and the result would have been the same.
See, that's interesting because, you know, having read other stuff about the Spanish-American War and then your book, I come somewhat to the opposite conclusion. I'm generally not someone who thinks that individual people tend to be the driving force of history. Uh-huh. And I really, in this case, I subscribe to that. And I think that, you know, Dewey's value of a replacement was, perhaps he did better than the generic naval commodore at this point, but that one way or another, Manila was going to be taken. Maybe it took a little longer. Maybe we took a little more, you know, maybe we took a few more losses, but Manila was going to be taken. But I think that the one thing that I did come to the conclusion of having read your book is that Dewey was a bit more unique in a good way in his handling of Manila and the Philippine situation post-conquest, right? Because
right.
Know, so we have defeated the Spanish fleet, but meanwhile, the Spanish army is not going anywhere, and they're currently in Manila, and they have no interest in giving up Manila. And it was a bit of a standoff, and he, I think, handled it extremely skillfully with no real-time communication from Washington. And this is where the decision-making had a lot more variability as compared to a battle where, you know, sail in, bang away, one side's going to win. Inevitably, it's the United States, just better stuff. Uh-huh. And here there's a lot more variability, and he does, I'd give him A- marks on that.
Yeah, he does a good job. I think he does quite a good job of managing the international tensions that immediately erupt after the destruction of the Spanish fleet. And the point about the Spanish fleet being destroyed is not that Dewey won the battle, really. It's that he won the battle by annihilating the whole Spanish fleet in the Philippines, which leaves the Philippines sort of open to any colonial power that might want it now. And the Spanish army has its hands full with an insurrection that it's been fighting in the Philippines for a long time. Dewey allows for the leader of that insurrection to come back to Manila, sort of come back to the leadership of the Philippines rebellion, puts him in charge. Emilio Aguinaldo comes back to the Philippines under Dewey's watch. Dewey says, go ashore, raise your army, and basically secure Manila for yourselves, because all I've got to do now is blockade Manila and make sure that nobody else gets in. And Dewey manages it really well until it becomes clearer and clearer that there are forces in D.C. that want to keep the Philippines as a colony.
And that involves the army, of which there was some less than inspired leadership, I would say.
Right. It's, you know, it's Dewey says, I need 5,000 troops just to secure Manila and to take the surrender of the Spanish garrison, because the Spanish garrison will surrender to the Americans, but they don't want to surrender to the Philippine rebels. But the army sends not 5,000, but ultimately more than 20,000. They send an army of conquest and occupation that Dewey was really sort of not prepared for. And Dewey had a really good relationship with the rebels on shore, because he didn't really think that they were a rival, but the army that arrives thinks the rebellion in the Philippines is now a rival.
And the leadership of the army, you know, fights and ultimately has to, due to their, I would say, undiplomatic handling of the situation, that eventually leads to the Philippine Rebellion, which there's a previous podcast episode that talks about that if anyone wants to go back and listen. But, you know, so Dewey sticks around for a pretty good amount of time.
He's there a long time. Yeah, he's there from May of 98 when the battle happens until August of 99. He's there for like 14 months.
Yeah, it's really a testament to what he saw as his duty, which was to oversee this Philippine transition.
Absolutely.
And I think that he was well aware that the army was doing poorly. And yeah, I got the impression at least that he was actively trying to counteract that while not trying to butt heads in a era in which the inter-service rivalry was extremely intense, you know, far, far more intense than the very minor Army-Navy rivalry is today.
For sure.
But, you know, so the one thing I wanted to ask you about is sort of how he goes from A to A minus in my book is he handles the other powers that want the Philippines well, but somewhat poorly in a strategic sense. And primarily I'm talking about the Germans, who were also late to the colonial race due to their late unification, but they are a extremely potent industrial power. They realize that a fleet is important. They start building a fleet, and they also realize that they have nothing in the Pacific, and they're poking around, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they want the Philippines, and they're convinced that the Americans aren't going to keep the Philippines. And if the Americans do want to stick around, the German commander seems pretty convinced that he can intimidate Dewey away from Manila. And Dewey proves that he's not going to be intimidated. And if the Germans want to fight, it's going to be their fault, but he'll give it to them.
And so Dewey does not back down. I think that he actually handled the Germans very well, but then he literally just pockets it. And this is something of extreme strategic importance, right? Is it not important that the Germans, a great power on the world stage, have been getting aggressive with the United States, and he literally tells nobody?
Exactly. You know, the McKinley administration, McKinley himself, doesn't hear about any of this until Dewey comes back, until there's the celebration for Dewey's return in D.C., until they have a big reception for him at the White House. And later that night, Dewey and McKinley and the inner circle, they're sitting around telling stories. And McKinley's looking at Dewey thinking, I can't believe you didn't tell me this already. You know, we almost came to blows with Germany, but I didn't think it, you know, I didn't think it warranted reporting it.
Right. I mean, in my mind, absolutely criminal. It was one of his flaws, and that wasn't unique. He had a tendency throughout his career to severely undershare, right? And I think that there's a...
I like that. I wish I had written that.
You know, there's a spot, right? I don't necessarily believe that military commanders owe minute reports in the style that they are often given back to the Pentagon in D.C. I don't think that all those reports are necessarily useful, but there are things of strategic significance that perhaps the greater political and military administration should be aware of. And, you know, he had a similar incident with Mexico in which he was early in his career, in which he you know, provoked a what turned out to be a one-sided diplomatic crisis, only because Mexico realized it as a diplomatic crisis, but no one in the United States was aware until, you know.
They read about it in the papers, right?
Yeah, until a couple months later. Yeah, and I would say that that is one of, if not his greatest command flaw that I took away having read your book.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. I understand why he did it, but that doesn't mean he should have done it.
Why did he do it? I can't see the logic.
It's I mean, just for his point, Dewey believes that he has an appreciation of the conditions in the theater that no one else is going to have. And that as a commander, it's his responsibility and no one else's to resolve the situation to the best interest of the United States. And he doesn't want somebody thousands of miles away giving him constant advice and suggestions because he has faith in himself to handle the situation fine. Now, see, whether he's accurate about this or not is sort of beside the point. He thinks, this is my field of responsibility. I'm going to handle it. I'm going to resolve the issue. And then later on, I'll report back. But as you point out, that leads to all sorts of strategic and upper level, you know, disconnects.
Yeah. So luckily, also that ends well. Dewey returns to the United States as the biggest celebrity that the United States has ever seen.
Right. And
Congress creates for him a special position, Admiral of the Fleet. How can you not, for the biggest military celebrity to ever come out of the United States? And, you know, he then is actually a pretty darn good guiding force for, you know, the second half of this era of naval inflection, right?
He really is. You know, once the whole celebrity thing wears off, and once he can go back to just being a capable, broad-minded, global visioned naval officer, then he begins to contribute again. But for about a year and a half, 2 years after he came home, the cloud of celebrity was around him so thick that he wasn't really able to enjoy himself or contribute much to the Navy. But him being at the head of the general board of the Navy that's created after the Spanish-American War was absolutely critical, because it allowed for his prestige to be transferred to this rather new and experimental idea of a naval planning board in peacetime. So he was a critical step in this, like you said, the second half of this inflection point.
And, you know, one of the things that I also learned about your book is, I sort of knew this in the abstract, but hadn't put it together until you explicitly did, was that Dewey and Mahan had a bit of a professional rivalry, but also played in parallel, where Mahan provided the theory for the first half of the 20th century Navy, while Dewey was the practitioner. And they jointly oversaw the United States having a modern Navy in time for World War One, and then that trend accelerated while the Navy maintained a decent-sized peacetime force in the interwar period. And that ultimately was the backbone that we built the wartime World War II fleet off of, which was the Navy's finest hour.
Exactly. You know, I think your point is well taken, that Mahan and Dewey together represented the two necessary elements of naval transformation into the 20th century. You had the thinker who had the ideas, and then you had the commander who had an appreciation of the interconnectedness of the oceans of the world, right? And could take a fleet of new ships into combat and show the American people what they were capable of doing.
Thank you, David. I really enjoyed your book, A New Force at Sea, George Dewey and the Rise of the American Navy. I'm going to put a link to that in the podcast show notes if anyone wants to order it. If you're interested in sort of the broader technological change of the Spanish-American War, as well as a biography of Dewey himself. So thank you very much, David. And I really hope to have you on the show again when you write another book.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. I appreciate you having me on. Great to talk to you.
And with that, please go ahead and rate and subscribe if you've not done so already. You can email me at usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. That link is also in the show notes. I love getting your emails. I have answered a lot of various naval what if and naval history questions via email. So please shoot them my way. Until next time, fair winds and following seas.